طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. It is said that converts are the best evangelists. In the case of Israeli author and activist Miko Peled, that certainly is true. Born to a prominent Israeli military family, his father was a general who was a major figure in both the war against Palestine in 1948 and 1967. But later in life, he became a critic of the Israeli state as it slipped into rampant Zionism and apartheid. His son, Miko, has gone further and has become a sharp critic of and major spokesman against Zionist injustice. This morning we feature the general's son, Miko Peled, doing his thing by speaking out at a Sabeel conference. We begin with his introduction.
Well, it's an honor to introduce my friend Miko. And I show my age because I was on a UN NGO committee with his father in the mid-80s, working on justice in Palestine. And I had such great respect for Mati Peled, this great general who turned toward peace and justice in Palestine. And those seeds were planted in that household with his mom too. And now we get to reap the benefits of the general's son, that book, who is a force for truth on this issue. And he's crisscrossing the world. He's just recently been speaking all over South Africa on the apartheid, anti-Israel apartheid movement. And he was in Czechoslovakia recently, all over the globe, and is feeling the solidarity of the movement. And now we have to bring that force here, and no better person to do it for us than Miko Peled. Let's walk.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Sabeel, for inviting me. Thank you all for being here. The question of hope is one that comes up a lot on this issue. And as you can all see, there are hundreds of people here and thousands across the world who are deeply engaged with this issue, where you could argue they have actually no reason to care about this issue whatsoever. And if that doesn't give hope, I don't know what does. On top of that, we've got great inspiration, wonderful leadership from people like Abuna Naim Atik. I don't know if you heard his talk last night, but I was up half the night thinking about it. I don't know that you hear many clergy who would say thank God for BDS, who would have the courage to say that. And he talked about, And he talked about courage and the need to have courage. And I need to thank him for his courage and his inspiration, because, of course, he's leading all of us here. And like I said, many others around the world. The issue of Palestine is obviously one that is covered up in layers of myth. And sometimes it's hard to sift through and get to the point. So I'm going to try to get to the point as quickly as possible. But I think there are two issues that have to be brought up, especially when we're in a Christian context. And that is the issue that somehow criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic. That somehow Israel is the answer to the Holocaust. And I think it's important to dispel these two myths as quickly as possible. There's nothing anti-Semitic about criticizing Israel, first of all, because there's nothing Jewish about Israel. There's nothing inherently Jewish about Zionism. There never was. The Zionists secularized Judaism and turned, decided that Jews are a nation. They secularized the Bible and turned it into a history book. They did this on their own. They represent no one. The fact is, most Jews do not live in Israel, did not heed to the call of Zionism, and most of the people who do live in Israel or under Israeli rule are not Jews. There's nothing inherently Jewish about holding thousands of political prisoners. There's nothing inherently Jewish about racist laws. There's nothing inherently Jewish about denying children water because they are non-Jews. So there's nothing Jewish about Israel, and there's nothing anti-Semitic about criticizing and rejecting Israel, not to mention look around the room and look at the speakers and see how many Jewish people are talking to you about this issue and rejecting Zionism. So I think it's important to talk about this. The other issue is this Holocaust issue, that Israel is the response to the Holocaust, that Israel is our defense as Jews, so there will not be another Holocaust. It's our guarantee. Well, let's take a look at what happened after the Holocaust, after World War II. Out of 2 million Jewish refugees who were in internment camps in Europe, all over Europe after World War II, how many went to Israel? Less than 10%, somewhere between 150 and 200,000. Out of 2 million, the vast majority of the very Jews who you would have thought would heed the call of Zionism said no. We want to regain our identity as Europeans, as Belgians, as French, or come to America. The answer to racism, whether it's anti-Semitism or any other kind of racism, is not more racism somewhere else. It's the end of racism everywhere. And many of the Holocaust survivors who did immigrate to Israel left, either because they were disgusted by the racism they saw there, or because they were treated very poorly by the Zionists, or for other reasons. So I think these are two myths that it's very, very important to dispel, particularly when we talk in a non-Jewish, in a Christian setting. Now, we heard a lot about the peace talks, and there's a lot of disappointment. Every time the peace talks fail, there's disappointment. And I think the reason there's disappointment is, of course, because we want peace, we want to see peace. But I think it's important to understand that the peace talks are failing because the peace talks are not meant to solve any problem. In fact, they are not even close to, they're not even going in a direction that can solve the problem in Palestine. And there's this illusion that there's an Israel and a Palestine, that we have two countries. These countries are at war, these people don't get along, and therefore we need an American broker to bring the sides together and make peace, and darn it, they just keep failing. These people just don't get along. But is this the reality? Are there two countries, two armies that are at war here? That's not the reality. Israel and Palestine, it's interesting, I just had this conversation outside with somebody. Israel and Palestine are two names for the same country. Israel and Palestine is the exact same place. It is one country. Governed by one government. It is one state, one army, two nations. But the problem here is not two countries at war. The problem that can and therefore it cannot be resolved by peace talks. The problem here is a problem of oppression and colonialism and racism. And the way to end that is through a concerted effort, an anti-apartheid effort, an anti-racism effort, which I would say I would call anti-Zionist effort, because Zionism replaced apartheid. And this is exactly why it's failing. It's failing because it's not supposed to succeed, because it's going in the wrong direction altogether. You cannot solve this problem without recognizing that the issue is the issue of oppression, of colonialism, and of racism. And the way to move ahead is to dismantle, and somebody, I heard the previous panel had this question, to dismantle the Zionist state in favor of a real democracy, just like was done in South Africa, where you had to dismantle apartheid in order to relieve the plight of black South Africans. This is the direction to go, and this is the only way we're going to see any change. And like I said earlier, through this very inspirational leadership of people like Naim Atik and other Palestinians, people who lead the BDS movement, people who lead the popular resistance, and others, young students on campuses. Many are Palestinians, many are not. Super here in town at the local university. These are the people, these are the movements, this is the direction it has to go. And I think this was said earlier today, and I'll say this again. Every generation, I think, is judged by a certain issue. I think the 60s, it was the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement here in America. The 80s, it was apartheid in South Africa. We are all going to be judged. We are all going to have to answer to this issue on Palestine now. This is the defining issue of our time. And all of us here, and everyone who stood for Palestine and stood for justice, we'll be able to tell our kids and our grandkids exactly where we stood, because they will ask, and they should ask. And the people who stood on the other side, and the people who waved the Israeli flag when bombs were falling on Gaza, and the people who support and excuse the crimes of Israel, will either hide in a corner somewhere or deny that they ever supported Israel. Just like today, you're not going to find anyone who supported apartheid in South Africa. Everybody loved Nelson Mandela. Suddenly. This is exactly the process that we're going to see, and I would bet that this is going to be much sooner than most people think. I think in 10 years, these people are all going to be sitting in a corner ashamed, or if they have any integrity, they will apologize for supporting Israel and for the crimes of Israel against the Palestinians. Now, often people talk about what happened, how did it all start, and generally it all started when white people in Europe thought they had the right to take somebody else's, one person's country, and give it to somebody else. So Zionists always talk about the Balfour Declaration as though it is the 11th commandment, as though it came down from the mountain with Moses, the Balfour Declaration. So Lord Balfour made a promise to his friend Lord Rothschild that Palestine will be given to the Jews as a homeland. Who is he to give anything to anybody anyway? But this is how it was. White people felt that they had the right to take brown people's land and give it to whoever they wanted. And that's exactly what happened. But in the end, I think, the beginning of the conflict, the way we need to talk about it, is when the United Nations decided, or somehow thought, that it had the right to partition Palestine and give a portion of it to the Jewish population, to the Jews, so to speak. So the Jews wanted a little bit, the Arabs wanted a little bit, we divided and we give these guys a little bit and that guys a little bit. And we'll solve the problem. Of course, this is the partition map. The partition of the 29th of November 1947, there's a street in Jerusalem named after that day. The problem is they decided to give the larger portion of the country to the smaller Jewish community. And they expected that the far larger Palestinian native community would accept this, would accept the smaller portion of the land. In 1947, there were about 500,000 Jews in Palestine. These were my grandparents who immigrated there, their generation, and my parents who were born there. The Palestinian population numbered about 1.5 million people. So you had a small community, 500,000 Jews, the native community of close to 1.5 million people, and they were supposed to accept this. And even today, people say, the problem is that the Arabs rejected the partition plan. That's why the conflict has been going on for so long. It's an absurd idea, it's an absurd proposition. Another reason this particular day is important is because from that day, we have two opposing histories, we have two opposing narratives that began on that day. What happened the day after? And the narrative I grew up with as an Israeli, and I'm sure most Americans learn, is that after the Arabs rejected this plan, they began a massive assault in order to kill and destroy the small Jewish community in Palestine. And thankfully, these young Jews who were there to fight, these descendants of King David who defeated Goliath, and these descendants of the Maccabees who defeated great empires, once again, they defeated the Arabs. And once again, a Jewish state was established in the land of Israel after 2,000 years. This is like a whole new chapter from the Bible. This is so romantic and so heroic. I mean, how could you even begin to refute a narrative like that? Problem is, once again, we look at the details, and then what we find is that the Palestinian narrative seems to make a little more sense. Because 1947, the two communities were hoping to be established as states. But there was one thing that the Jewish, the Zionist community in Palestine had invested in heavily the Palestinians never did. And that is the thing that made all the difference. It was an armed militia. The Zionist militia, in which my father was an officer, by 1947 numbered close to 40,000 armed, well-trained, highly motivated men. There was no equivalent on the Palestinian side. So who are these Arabs that attacked? If there was no Palestinian militia, who are these Arabs that attacked? We know other Arab armies intervened later on, 6, 7, 8 months later, intervened in Palestine, and even they were defeated very easily by the Zionist militia. But who are these Arabs that attacked? And what Israeli historians like Ilan Pape and others have been validating now is the Palestinian story that the Arabs didn't attack. As soon as the United Nations accepted this idea of a Jewish state in Palestine, the Zionist militia began a massive assault, a massive campaign that can only be categorized as terrorism and ethnic cleansing. A terrorist attack that lasted a year against a civilian, unarmed population in an attempt to complete the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and establish a Jewish state. Within 12 months, they managed to conquer almost the entire country, almost 80% of the country. They managed to destroy hundreds and hundreds of cities and towns and villages and force into exile somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people. Not such a romantic story, but the pieces somehow fit the puzzle now. And another claim that we hear quite often is that, well, maybe a few Arabs were kicked out, maybe a few villages were destroyed, but really there was nothing there. Anything that was there of any value, of any progress, was brought by the Jews, by the Zionists. So I'd like to show this picture of the city of Jaffa before 1948. The city of Jaffa sits on the Mediterranean, or sat on the Mediterranean coast, a major Arab city, close to 120,000 people, a rich political life, rich business life, trade unions and teachers' guilds and writers' guilds. Several newspapers were printed in Jaffa. They had movie theaters and concert halls. All the greatest names in the Arab world would come to perform in Jaffa. And in a matter of 2 weeks in 1948, this city of close to 120,000 was reduced to less than 4,000 people, concentrated in one neighborhood with barbed wires and Israeli guards surrounding them. And today, on that spot, almost from the exact same angle, sits the city of Tel Aviv, an Israeli city. The city of Tel Aviv calls itself Tel Aviv Yafa because they kept a small part of Yafa still, and there is still a small Palestinian population in Yafa, neglected, deprived, oppressed, and subject to racist laws and harassment from the Israeli military. Now, why is this important? Not only to know what happened. This is also important in the context of where we go forward. To try to reduce Palestine to the West Bank and Gaza is a huge mistake, because Palestine is the entire country. The suffering Palestinians take place in the entire country. The Palestinians who live in Jaffa, like many Palestinians in other parts of Israel, what is called Israel, are subject to racist laws. They're all Israeli citizens. Israeli police does not go in to solve crime in places like Jaffa. So, of course, crime thrives. Murder cases go on for decades unresolved, unsolved. The only form of law enforcement that enters Palestinian communities inside Israel are the Mishmar Gvul, the border police, whose whole aim is to terrorize and to harass Palestinians. Now, I'm sure many of you have heard the term Nakba, the catastrophe. And I remember when I heard the term Nakba the first time, I was actually offended, because the Nakba means the catastrophe, it refers to what happened in 1948, and I was thinking, how can anybody refer to the war of 1948, the war that we call the War of Independence, as a catastrophe? Maybe a few Arabs suffered, but basically this was an important event. The revival of the Jewish people and so on. Well, over the years, through my journey to Palestine, I talk about this in the book as well, I learned why it's called a Nakba. But I think what people fail to realize is that the Palestinian Nakba did not begin in 1948. I mean, did not happen in 1948. It began in 1948. It continues to this day. I took this picture in a refugee camp about a year ago. As you can see, there's no sewage. I can tell you there's no running water, there's no electricity, there's no access to health care, there's no access to proper nutrition. Now, this is not in some remote mountaintop in Afghanistan. This could be half an hour drive, 20-minute drive, maybe an hour's drive from major modern cities inside Israel, into which these children are not permitted to enter. They're the very places from where their grandparents were kicked out. There is no reason for these children to live like this. You're not going to see Israeli children live like this, look like this. The Palestinian Nakba continues. This catastrophe continues. It gets worse and worse by the day. It is funded by the ongoing Nakba. The continuation of the Nakba is funded by our tax dollars. It is shameful. It is inexcusable. It is unjustifiable. And it's happening every day under our watch. Which is why it's time for action. Now, there's a story, I'm sure some of you may have heard me tell the story, but if you haven't, it's in the book as well. And it's a story that has to do with my mother. My book is a memoir, so my entire family was very much involved with the creation and the establishment of the State of Israel. My mother's father signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. He was an important Zionist leader. My father was a general, and so on. And there's a story that my mother told me many, many times as I was growing up about something that she experienced in 1948. Now, she was born and raised in Jerusalem. By the way, how many people here have been to Palestine? Israel. Oh, okay. All right. I risk my case. And so she was born and raised in Jerusalem, not the old city of Jerusalem, but the neighborhoods that were built outside of the old city, in the modern side of Jerusalem, which later became the Israeli side. So she was born and raised there. She knew the city well. She knew the people well. And of course, there were some significant and well-to-do Palestinian neighborhoods and Palestinian communities living in Jerusalem on the western side, outside of the old city. In 1948, my mother was a young mother already. She was 22. That's that picture. By the way, she's 87. She still lives in Jerusalem, and she's doing very well. In 1948, the Zionist forces came in, took the Palestinian neighborhoods, forced the people out, and made these beautiful homes available to Israeli families. And if you've been there and you've seen these, the neighborhoods are there, the homes are still there, they're very distinct Palestinian Jerusalemite homes. Well, my mother refused. And the way she told me the story many, many times, and she still does when we talk about this, is with such emotion. She'll say, how could I possibly have taken the home of another mother? How could I move into the home of another family that now has to live in exile? Now, besides being a very good story, and besides hoping that more people would have done what she did, of course, most people didn't, there was something about the story that was very troubling to me growing up. And I was only able to really understand why it was troubling when I was working on the book several years ago. She was presenting a moral dilemma in a narrative that has no moral dilemmas, that is morally perfect. Her story was contradicting the national narrative. The Zionist narrative is morally perfect. The land belongs to us, because we are the Jews and we are the descendants of the ancient Hebrews. Though there's little historical evidence to that, but that's what the Zionists claim. Very little historic evidence, but that's what the Zionists claim. So it's our land, we deserve it all. We, because we are gracious and generous and moderate and compromising, agreed to the partition plan, which gave us only most of the country, but not all of it. They attacked us, we won, and then we asked them to stay, and they left. We asked them to stay, we asked the Arabs to stay, and they left. So where's the moral dilemma? They left, a home is available, a family needs a home, my mother was living with her parents, with two small children. Where's the moral dilemma? Why was she presenting a moral dilemma? The Zionist narrative is so perfect that even when they do talk about atrocities, I'm sure many of you have heard of the massacre of Deir Yassin, which is one of several. Deir Yassin was a small village on the outskirts of an important Zionist leader, later on the president of the State of Israel, said, thank you. He said that while the massacre was a terrible thing, thankfully as a result of the massacre, thousands of Arabs fled, and that allowed us to create a Jewish majority. And we all know, boys and girls, there is nothing more important than a Jewish majority in the land of Israel. So even this atrocity, we come out on top morally. We bomb Gaza and we kill children today, but it's okay because Hamas is in Gaza and they're terrorists. The Zionist narrative is always morally perfect. So this is what the map looked like for the first 20 years, between 1948 and 1967. By the way, this map still exists, but only in the minds of a few people. In reality, this map no longer exists. And then 1967 rolled around. We're not going to get into all the history, but basically what the Israeli military did is this. They crossed, they took the rest of Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, the two areas that Israel had not occupied yet, crossed Palestine off the map completely and established a single state over the entire country. Now, two interesting things happened when that took place. My father was a general. He was a member of the Israeli High Command at that time. After the war, he stood up and he said, well, we now have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem. We conquered all this land, we're strong, we're undefeatable, but we still have another nation here. We need to make peace with this nation, we need to respect them and allow them to establish a state in the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, he brought intelligence reports that prove that the local leadership were willing to do this and were interested. He said, if we don't do this now, we will become an occupation force, there will be resistance, our army will have to be used to fight the resistance, it will have terrible implications and terrible effects on the moral fiber of the state of Israel and the moral fiber of the Israeli army, and eventually we will become a binational state. Every single thing he said came true. And as he was saying these words, the Israeli bulldozers were already destroying Palestinian cities and towns and villages. Israeli soldiers were forcing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to leave the West Bank. And a massive building project began immediately in the West Bank, just like Israel had done in other parts of Palestine 20 years earlier. There is no difference between the West Bank and the rest of Israel. So today, and again, once again, why is this important? Because in today's context, peace talks and all of this discussion about the two-state solution. Israel didn't take the West Bank by mistake. It didn't build settlements by mistake. The Israeli army, one of the Israeli army's first orders as they took the West Bank was that the water in the West Bank belongs to the state of Israel. The West Bank is one of the largest water sources in the country. There is no more West Bank, there is no more possibility, there never was a possibility for a two-state solution, because Israel doesn't want it. To imagine that there would be an Israeli government that would allow the Palestinians to establish a state between the river and the sea is a complete misunderstanding of what Zionism is, of what Israel is. And the peace talks and 67 years of the existence of the state of Israel proves that. Nothing was done by mistake. And they say this. Israeli commanders, Israeli politicians, Israeli prime ministers have said it for years. There's no difference between the cities in the West Bank and other cities. This is Israel, this is Israel. This is Jewish land, this is Jewish land. Palestinians, well, it's not our problem. I think this is important to get into all of our hearts and minds. There is no scenario in which the state of Israel will allow the creation of a Palestinian state or recognize Palestinian rights. Just like the apartheid in South Africa, apartheid regime could not recognize rights of blacks and colored people in South Africa. It's an impossibility, which is why we need to reframe the struggle, I believe. We hear all the time that Israel wants peace. In fact, this came up now. Once again, the peace talks are falling apart, but Israel wants peace. Don't be misled. Israel really wants peace. Well, let's examine this, okay? So, as my father said, after the war, Israel had an opportunity to establish a Palestinian state. Of course, they went on to completely build settlements and so forth and integrate the West Bank. In the mid-1970s, my father and other Israelis put together or formed an organization that was dedicated to this cause, the recognition of Palestinian rights to self-determination in the West Bank and Gaza, and the rights of Palestinians who remained Israeli citizens to full equal rights. Of course, two things that had not happened. Don't exist today. As soon as my father and the others created this organization, they were contacted by the PLO. They were contacted by Yasser Arafat's top deputies in order to begin a discussion on how this might work. On the Palestinian side, these were officials of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. On the Israeli side, there were people like my father who used to hold high office, who were well respected but had no political power at all. In this picture, my father is with Issam Sartawi, who was a Palestinian ambassador in Paris for many, many years. They became very good friends. So they would go to meetings. At first they were in secret. They'd meet in Europe. They'd meet in North Africa. And whenever they would return, my father would always go and report to the prime minister. He still had that kind of access in those days. So the Israeli government was kept abreast and fully informed about these meetings. They wanted nothing to do with it. In 1983, a delegation, including my father, met with Yasser Arafat in Tunis. It was highly publicized. There were pictures. It was in the press. Shortly after that, in a move that was led by Shimon Peres, the Israeli Knesset passed a law that made these meetings illegal. The meetings of these Israelis with the PLO illegal. So that was the 80s. Another decade gone. Suddenly 1993 rolls around and it's the Oslo peace talks. The White House lawn, September 1993, Bill Clinton is there, Arafat is there, Yitzhak Rabin is there, and they're signing Oslo Accords. Now by 1993, some of us of course are old enough to remember, the Soviet Union fell, the Berlin Wall fell, apartheid in South Africa fell, and there was a sense that Palestine is next. Peace was coming. So there was a lot of optimism. What people failed to realize is that by 1993 there was no more possibility to create a Palestinian state because there was no more West Bank. The West Bank was already fully integrated into Israel. Oslo was not an attempt to bring about peace. Oslo was an attempt by Israel to bring the Palestinians to surrender. And because the Palestinians would not surrender, there's no peace. Now people say that Oslo failed. Oslo did not fail. Oslo is a huge success. It accomplished exactly what it was set to do, to strengthen the Israeli hold on the country and its resources, and to make life harder for the Palestinians. When the Palestinians agreed to the two-state solution under the leadership of Yasser Arafat, Yasser Arafat was willing to give up almost 80% of historic Palestine, the right of the Palestinians to return, and agree to recognize and make peace with the very state that destroyed Palestine. And because he would go no further, he was accused of not making concessions. So when Bill Clinton brought everybody to Camp David and it didn't work, Arafat was blamed for not making concessions. Arafat was in fact the most consistent voice for peace in the Middle East for three decades. From the mid-1970s till the day he died in 2004, he was completely consistent in his willingness to make peace with Israel based on the two-state solution, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. Israel is not interested, was not interested, and still will never be interested. This is not what Israel is about. Now, you know, there's this letter to the Pope about the Palestinian children who are in prison. I think the issue of the Palestinian prisoners is one of the most important issues, is it's hardly ever talked about. Israel holds thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails. Has done for decades. Israel calls them security threats, terrorists, and so forth. The reality, though, is, and this is according to Israeli researchers, Israeli papers, the vast majority of Palestinians in Israeli jails have never been charged with acts of violence. I'll say it again. The vast majority of Palestinians held in Israeli jails have not been charged with acts of violence, and this is by the very low standard of the Israeli military system, the Israeli military courts. According to them, a child with a rock is a terrorist, is a security threat. These are political prisoners, these are political leaders, intellectuals, clergymen, and others. And their crime is that they dare to resist. Now, we know that the world community has recognized the rights of people to resist. The rights of people to resist racist and alien colonial domination is legal according to international law. If Israel doesn't like Qassam rockets coming out of Gaza, Israel can end the occupation of Gaza and allow the Palestinians freedom. I remember my father being asked once, as a former general, he was asked, well, how do you talk to terrorists? He said, well, terrorism is a terrible thing. At the same time, when a small nation is occupied by a larger power, quite often terrorism is the only means at their disposal. At the same time, it's important to recognize that, as is reflected in the prison population, the vast majority of Palestinian resistance has been like this, has been unarmed. Has been led by people like Naim Atik, who are as far as possible, for as far as you can possibly be, from thoughts of killing people or an armed resistance. Of course, the armed resistance gets all the fame, gets all the glory, gets all the press. But this is the reality. Now, I'm going to take you back for a moment to my own personal story. Some of you, I know the story because you've read the book or you've heard me speak. But in 1997, my sister's daughter was killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. And I was already living in the U.S. at the time. And as you can imagine, this is big news in Israel. Whenever there used to be suicide attacks, of course, this was big news. In this case, this was the granddaughter of a famous Israeli general who later on became an advocate for Palestinian rights. So it was even bigger news. When I heard, I took the first plane home. I reached my sister's apartment. It was packed with people who came to mourn, both Palestinians and Israelis. And the press, every news outlet, every news agency from every country, every language you could possibly imagine was there. And the questions are always the same. The questions are, well, first of all, who's responsible? Then how do we get them? And then how many of them do we kill? And how do we make them, you know, learn their lesson? How do we teach them? And so on. Well, my sister Nurit, who I think some of you have met, came out finally after the funeral. She said two things that I felt were earth-shattering. First thing she said was, in terms of revenge, retaliation, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. Don't talk to me about killing more people. The idea of killing people in response to somebody's death is deplorable. It's insane. And she quoted from a famous Jewish poet, Bialik, who wrote that even the devil himself could not come up with a vengeance that's appropriate for the death of a child. And as for who's responsible, she said, well, let's take a look. Who is taking Palestinian land, destroying Palestinian homes, throwing Palestinian fathers and brothers in jail, shooting Palestinian children in the schoolyard, depriving them of water, depriving them of freedom? Who's doing all of this? It's the Israeli government. And both she and her husband Rami said, we hold the Israeli government directly responsible for our daughter's death. Because what do we expect? Do we expect that we can maintain this brutal oppression against another nation and there will be no consequences? There will be no price to be paid? And of course innocents are going to die. This is the reality. And it's a reality that we have imposed upon the Palestinians. Now she's become an activist. She's written a great book about the Israeli education system. I recommend you check it out. It's called Palestine and Israeli School Books. It's a very good book. It talks about the racism in the Israeli education system. Her sons and her other sons and her husband have all become activists. And I went back to the U.S., in San Diego where I live, and well, how do you pick up the pieces? How do you go back to life after you carried the small coffin and took it to its final resting place? But I was very fortunate in that in San Diego I found a Jewish-Palestinian discussion group, a dialogue group. And that was my first meeting with Palestinians. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. And you've been there, you've seen it, supposedly a mixed city. And this is something that when I mentioned in South Africa, people knew exactly what I was talking about. Even though you have Israelis and Palestinians, it's a completely racist, segregated city. So as an Israeli, you don't meet Palestinians. First time I met Palestinians was in San Diego, and the chapter in the book begins with a line, my journey into Palestine began in San Diego. I was 39 years old. But beyond that, it was the first time that I was with Palestinians in the same place, and we were equal under the law. There is no place. Not in Yaffa, not in the Galilee, not in the Negev, not in the West Bank, not in Jerusalem, where Israelis and Palestinians live under the same rules and laws, where Israelis and Palestinians are equal. And that was another thing that the people in South Africa could understand, that really powerful feeling when you're with the other suddenly and you're equal. There were no checkpoints, there were no laws, there were no curfews, there were no permits that they needed. And you could speak at eye level, you can talk to each other. And gradually I began hearing about the Nakba, I began hearing about the Palestinian narrative, I began realizing that there's a whole other people, there's a whole other country that I never knew, even though I was raised there and I live right next to them, and these are the Palestinians. And then I began to venture into Palestine and go into Palestinian communities and, you know, drive into the West Bank and so forth. Now, the way the book ends and the way I'll end my remarks today, and I think this is something we all need to pay attention to, is where do we go from here? Accepting the state of Israel means accepting a single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people. The only way to maintain a state like that is through a brutal regime, military regime, through a system that creates thousands of political prisoners and maintains thousands of political prisoners, through racist laws. Israel has to maintain the violence. Israel has to keep bombing Gaza. Israel has to keep killing Palestinians in the West Bank in order to maintain its existence and explain why there's no peace, so they attack and they blame the Palestinians. Through an education system that's a racist education system, this is the only way to maintain the Jewish state. So anybody who supports the state of Israel needs to own up to that. You need to own up to the fact that if we support the state of Israel, we're supporting a brutal, racist regime. And many people are okay with that. Many people supported South Africa when it was a brutal, racist regime. But we have to own up to it. Accepting the two-state solution, or talking about the two-state solution as though it's a solution, means allowing Israel to do everything and anything it wants and maintain this brutal, racist state. This is the reality. But there is another option. Like we saw in South Africa, like we saw in Latin America, there is another option. There is an option to remove the racist regime. And I would say that today, Zionism took the place of apartheid. We talked about an anti-apartheid movement, there has to be an anti-Zionist movement, an anti-Zionism movement. Removing Zionism and establishing a real democracy will allow Israelis and Palestinians to live together in peace. Israelis are not going to like it, maybe at first, but privileged groups never like change, that's the way it is. But there is no reason why Israelis and Palestinians cannot live in a real democracy. The myths have to be brushed away, the fear has to be brushed away, we have to follow courageous leaders, and we have to line up clearly behind the banner of a single democracy with equal rights. You've been there, almost all of you have been there. You've seen it's a beautiful country with beautiful people with a great deal of potential. The only thing that's missing is equal rights. And for that we must fight. Thank you all very much.
You have been listening to Miko Peled, the General's Son, doing what he does best, exposing the injustices of the Israeli state. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.